Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we appreciate you being here on this Thursday morning. We have a lot to talk about, and we have a great group to do it with, so we will get started. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we'll get to the news of the day in just a moment. Let me introduce the group to you, and we welcome Fran Merman to the show, Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Merman, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm sitting here in my beautiful abode in Northampton wishing the sun was out.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. We have yet another rainy weekend apparently forecast, so maybe we can buck that trend, but we'll see. Here we are. Well, no better time than just stay
By
glued
the way,
to the radio.
Joe, I was going to say, I was listening to Ray on the fun drive, and it reminded me of when I was chair of a board, and we wanted all board compliance for fundraising, and we used to say, whether you donate the cost of a Starbucks or the cost of a Starbucks franchise, we welcome your money.
Oh, there you go.
So there you go.
Yeah, that's a very wide window. That's pretty good. yes, from A to Z. Fran, it's great to hear your voice. Thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead. I screwed this up last time. It's Executive Director of Communities for Local Power.
You got it this time. You got
it. Okay.
You're crushing it.
Because it just says, like, local power, you know, and which is cool. That is good. But it's Executive Director of Communities for Local Power, a former White House Advance Lead. Anna Markowitz is here. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's really nice to have you on the program this morning. We also welcome Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
How are you?
I'm fine. You know, I want my neighbors to know that I'm not by design honoring No Mow May. I just can't get my lawnmower out into the yard yet. It's like a swamp.
It is. It's swampy, and it's, you get maybe a day, and you think you're going to be all right, and then you get out there, and you realize, this is not going to be all right.
This tractor's going to get stuck.
Yeah, this is not going to work. And I just want to say, I was away for a couple of days, and I had some responsibilities in teaching at Bennington College, and Judy Patrick was so nice, and she took over my class so I could go away. And I'm reading the essays now, but the students loved you.
Well, how nice! And I would like to say that this was an attentive class, that they were paying attention, they were not on their phones, they were asking questions. It really was quite wonderful.
Yeah, it's a nice group of kids, and look forward to seeing them this afternoon. But thank you so much for doing that. We also welcome Robert Pondicio, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning. How are you?
I am well, Joe. Good morning. Welcome back from the mother country. And how am I this morning? I'm frozen. I live about 20 miles south of here in beautiful Medusa, New York, and it was 39 degrees when I pulled out of my driveway an hour ago. Like, I had to check the calendar.
Yeah, it's a weird May. It's a very weird May.
You think?
And so, but here we are. Yeah. And it's obviously strange because we have a holiday weekend. You think of Memorial Day as being the kickoff to the summer season.
And put on your coat and go to a barbecue.
That's right. Yeah. It's like, are the ski areas open? Great.
Memorial Day weekend and President's Day weekend weather.
All right. Let us begin and say this to you. The House has approved Donald Trump's massive tax immigration package. The legislation would extend tax cuts and add billions in new spending and trillions in debt. There were holdouts. There were a lot of meetings between the president and those. He went to Capitol Hill. Also, he spoke with those who were holding out yesterday in a long meeting to talk to those. And so this the bill is formally known. People got mad at us yesterday for calling it this as if it were an editorial. But the bill is formally known as the Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. That's what it's called. I can't change that. I'm sorry. It extends trillions of dollars in tax cuts from his first term, along with new campaign promises, including no taxes on tips and overtime wages and hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending. But the legislation, which passed 215 to 214 after marathon talks, carries a hefty price tag. The latest projection from the Congressional Budget Office, lawmakers' nonpartisan bookkeeper, showed it will add $2.4 trillion over 10 years to the national debt, which already exceeds $36 trillion. To offset the cost, the measure would slash spending on social safety net programs by more than $1 trillion over 10 years. Even then, the mammoth legislation could also force nearly $500 billion in cuts to Medicare over the next decade to keep the national deficit within legal limits, unless Congress leader adjusts those limits. The legislation could strip Medicaid coverage from 8.7 million to and lead to 7.6 million more uninsured people over 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The final vote came just before 7 o'clock this morning, wrapping up a more than 24-hour session that started in committee at 1 a.m. Determined to pass the bill to keep it on a long track to win approval. And by the way, that was 1 a.m. Wednesday, so that was going all through the day. 1 a.m. Wednesday, determined to pass the bill to keep it on a long track to win approval by July. House Republicans forced debate deep into the night as each caucus hauled in food, coffee, and other energy drinks to keep the bleary-eyed lawmakers alert and ready to go. So, Judy.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate the House for actually working hard. But you can bet they're all on planes headed home right now. It's hard to separate the politics from the actual fiscal implications of it. As a taxpayer, as a resident, I can't help feeling disillusioned by the whole thing. I'm worried about the debt. I'm worried about the cuts to services. And I know it's going to go to the Senate and it's going to be changed. But mm-hmm. the overall thrust of it seems like it's bad for the debt and it's bad for services. Now, the devil's in the details. Let's see what these Medicaid cuts actually mean. But from the get-go, I'm seeing a ton more paperwork requirements or application requirements. And it seems like that's going to add to the federal bureaucracy and not going to be efficient. I appreciate the need to hold people receive government services accountable, but it just seems like these are barriers to receiving Medicaid. And if anything, we've been building up our society to ensure more people, to give them good health coverage. And that's something Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants. And it seems like this is going to take more and more people out of the healthcare system, and that ultimately will be bad for our society.
Anna?
Yeah. I mean, here's looking to you, Senate. Mm-hmm. Please don't pass this. But I was just very disappointed. I didn't think that they were going to pull it together. I thought more than two House members were going to vote no from the Republican side, with so many people facing barriers of needing to work. They pushed up that deadline to 2026, which is just terrible. So I'm highly disappointed. I think Hakeem Jeffries said it pretty well with his prediction that this is the moment that is going to cost the Republicans the House for the next election. I think that people are going to see the impact of their day-to-day life. They're going to see that they're losing their health care, that they're losing their SNAP benefits, that this is going to raise costs for the lowest income Americans by 2% and raise the income for the highest Americans by 4%. And like, that's just not the direction that we need to go. It's not protecting the middle class.
Robert.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Judy on this. The devil is in the details. And with Anna, you know, you got to wait and see what the Senate does. There'll be reconciliation, et cetera. So, you know, this conversation is a little bit of blue sky right now. But look, having said that, folks on the right don't like this either. You know, if you're a fiscal hawk, you are, you know, livid about $4.1 trillion, I think, in revenue loss. You're upset about a nearly $5 trillion deficit hike. You know, heresy, perhaps, to say in New York State, but is it really a good idea to raise the SALT deduction to, what is it, $30,000? So
40 in the new one.
40, okay.
They had to raise it even more.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, this is famously a bit of a bugaboo on the right because, and I tend to agree with this, you know, you're asking, you know, low-tax red states to subsidize, pay more for the federal government, so to speak, as a share of the federal government than states like ours. So there's a lot not to like here, whether you're on the left or the right.
We talk about, Anna, you brought this up about the Senate. What do we know? What do we think of how this is going to go down?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, I was surprised that it passed in the House. So I feel like I would be even more surprised if it passed in the Senate. I mean, I feel like it's easier for the first body to pass something because they can make a big statement, whereas the second one, they're like, oh, no, this is really going to become law if we do this. Let's think about this more rationally. We can't just be making political statements to get reelected. So I don't know. I hope that people think about it practically and think about the millions of people that are going to lose their benefits.
I think the political calculation from the Republicans was they're going to lose the House anyway, way in the midterms, because the fact there are so many factors against them that they're thinking they may as well go for what they can go for as long as they have the votes. I also heard that the actual margin was 2 votes, but there was one House of Representative member who fell asleep at his desk and missed the vote entirely.
No.
That's
oh God,
Fran Berman.
Well, I'm still waiting not to see so many pennies. Just saying. There were a lot of losers among things that I personally care about. Among them were, you know, universities and the potential tax increase on endowments. Kind of anybody depending on the government providing some sort of safety net were losers, and that includes, you know, poor people and people that use the services of Planned Parenthood. Public lands were a loser. We're going to see, you know, more drilling and mining on them. Among the winners were service members. Through the Department of Defense, kids with this MAGA account, that's not so clear. Mass deportation was a real winner. We're going to be funding more of that. So, you know, all in all, what worries me in the long run, I mean, look, I believe personally that the Trump administration is really stressing a system that was broken in many ways, had many cracks, many things that we were worried about. On the other side of this, whatever that is, it's not going to go back to the way it was before. And I think the challenge for us now is how do we not just regroup, but how do we move forward to do the best of what this country can do for its constituencies? And so when I look at this and it continues to demolish safety net, demolish education, demolish our value for our resources, we better get cracking, because the local will be all about who votes for what and whether things get through and what Congress looks like next time around. But on the other side of that, no matter what those scenarios are, I think it's really important that we have a plan.
Fran, can I ask a question? So, you know,
sure.
I share, you know, with your views on the safety net and whatnot, but at some point we have to be clear and make hard decisions if we're going to reduce the deficit. Well, where's that going to come from?
You know, I completely agree. And you know what I mourn really, Robert, is that I mourn the fact that people don't seem to be able, at least not in the in the sort of public domain. They're really thoughtful conversations about that. I mean, I do think there are philosophical differences between a big safety net and a small safety net mm-hmm. on how we control the deficit, on where we raise money from. But when I look at the media and all of the things that I'm hearing, it really is all about winning and losing. Or, you know, who am I mad at today and how can I make them suffer? And so I would really welcome that kind of discussion because I do think one has to be fiscally prudent.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, what you spend money on and how much of a safety net you need, you know, we have worked examples from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And we should be thinking about what works right, what works well for America.
A minute warning.
Yeah, no, I think Judy said it quite well, you know, that this is the politics overwhelming, you know, the practical governing, as it were. My words, not yours, Judy. But look, at some point, we've got to have that hard conversation, right? We've got to make hard decisions. I think everybody agrees we can't go on like this, but nobody's willing to say, okay, here's the pound of my flesh that you can have.
But unfortunately, we're not even getting any decreases to the deficit by right. cutting these programs. He's actually increasing the deficit by lowering taxes. So somehow we're getting the worst of both worlds.
That's why this is a disappointment to everyone.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation, much more to discuss about the passing of this bill, and then it's moving on to the Senate. We also will welcome, as always, your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will return after this.
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. We are just very briefly interrupting the roundtable panel to remind you that you can support programs like this one that you love, that you tune into every day, that you email in about very often, that you comment on the post of it on Facebook. You are invested in this show, and we hope that you will invest in the future of it.
This is a lockbox, Sarah LaDuke, and that
sure
means
is.
Everything we raise now counts on the beginning of the fund drive, which is Monday, June 2nd. So far, $313,688, which thank you, everybody. It's really great. We have a ways to go. We have a $1.25 million drive, but that's over a quarter way.
That's over a quarter of the way to our total, which is marvelous.
Right.
We're so grateful for all the generosity that so many of you have shown already. And we're just hoping that more of you can come through as soon as possible. Keep the fund drive as short as it could possibly be by helping us reach our goal quickly, really quickly. Vite.
All right. We only have a couple of minutes here.
We do.
WAMC.org is a great place to make your pledge. Even when we are not blabbing at you, you can make a pledge anytime. 365 days a year at WAMC.org. It's a secure online pledge. You can find out all about becoming a sustainer, or you can find out about premiums. It's all there. And while you're listening to the roundtable panel this morning, perfect time to go online, make that pledge, help us fill the lockbox.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Programs like the Roundtable and other programs that we produce and provide here aren't just radio. They're civic spaces made possible by you, available for you to learn information, you know, develop your opinions and insights about the world, formulate the choices you will make when you enter, say, a voting booth or other, you know, endeavors where you have an impact on the future of the country and your local community. We're here to help keep you informed about the goings on throughout the region and throughout the world. And we hope and we know that if you listen and you value that, you will show up for us now with a little bit of scratch. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
And by the way, it doesn't have to be much scratch.
No.
It could be a buck or two or a hundred or a thousand, whatever is comfortable for you. We always say this and we mean it 100%. If you have a little bit and you want to be a part of this enterprise that we call Northeast Public Radio, you can do it. If it's a buck or two, fine. If you're a fat cat and you have a couple $100 million in the bank, you could end the fund drive right now. And I'm not kidding. 800-323-9262.
If you're a billionaire and you're like, I shouldn't exist, let me give away a lot of my money. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Can you imagine having that much money? I
can't
even fathom it.
I can't. And not to be self-righteous, but I think I would donate a lot. If I had a lot of money, I would donate a lot of
money. Would you donate to the lockbox?
Maybe.
What do you got?
Nothing now.
All right.
Nothing now. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. 1-800-323-9262. In tough times, your gift protects this vital institution. WAMC has always relied on our listeners to stay free and independent. A enormous part of our operating costs, which we are running a tight ship here, but an enormous part of our operating costs comes from you, the listeners, and we hope you'll continue to be there for us. We're fairly certain you will, but the only way to be 100% certain is if you do show up. We can't prove it until it happens.
That is entirely true. The number to make your pledge, and we know that Judy and Joe Makowicz are right over there in the Fund Drive room ready to take your pledge. 800-3, there he is. Hello, Joe. 800-323-9262. Or you can go online if you don't want to talk to the Makowicz. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Your gift powers it all. Your early gift helps shorten the fund drive. You can donate at WAMC.org or give us a call, 800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. We are supported by you, our listeners, and not shareholders. That makes all the difference in our ability to operate as morally and journalistically as we can, and we need you to keep supporting that. There's no two ways about it.
And we're going to go back to the roundtable in just a couple of seconds here. And here's a thought experiment for you as you listen. And so many people really, really love the roundtable panel. And they love interacting via email with the show and hearing their comments read. As you hear the panel, which we're going back to in 20 seconds, just imagine what it was like, what it would be like if it was not there. And it cannot be there without your support. So if you love it, back it up. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
800-323-9262. Back to the roundtable panel.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 22nd of May. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you on this Thursday morning as we discuss the news of the day, including this story about the bill that was being pushed very hard by the president personally and was in some question yesterday as to whether it would pass. There were holdouts, a lot of meetings, a lot of direct appeals to congressional representatives who were saying that they had problems with it. I will note, I noted this yesterday, I'll note it again today, that most of those problems were that those who were backing off of it didn't believe that it went far enough. It wasn't that they felt it was going too far. It was that it was not going far enough. So we have some letters from people. Let's get to those. Ken says, I understand the new bill contains a provision which would defund enforcement of contempt of court citations issued against those who fail to comply with court injunctions and that it is retroactive for orders issued before the bill has been enacted. This would seem to have far-reaching consequences for the current administration, and I have not seen nor heard any media reporting on this issue. Oh, that just sets Judy off. And my mind is boggled as to why not. Anxiously awaiting your comments. Thank you, and I love your show.
You know, I haven't heard it either, but I can let me be straight on this one. These big bills where you pack everything, including the kitchen sink, into one, what happens is you don't get a debate on a particular issue. That's a good issue. Let's debate it. Let's be up and down. Let's have every congressperson say whether or not they're for or against it. Putting everything together is the strategy in Washington to get this kind of omnibus thing passed. But what it does is negate our ability to understand what Congress is doing. What we'll find—I mean, I think this bill is 800 pages long or more.
1,100, I think.
Why? Right? Why not do your job and vote on everything one at a time? I mean, at the local level, that's what we're used to. The town board will vote on a particular issue, and we'll all get to weigh in and understand what it's happening. When you do it like this, the people don't understand. We feel like we've been hoodwinked.
Fran, anything you'd like to add?
I agree. I do think, you know, we need kind of measured, you know I'm in fantasy land here, by the way. I think we need measured conversation on everything. And I do think these big bills, they hide a multitude of sins. And you know, I completely agree with that. I think it's often infeasible to get a lot of stuff done a little bit at a time. And I think we have to sort of figure out a way to kind of weigh in on those things. But, yeah, I agree with that.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I also agree with what Judy said. I think that it would be great if they broke it down into smaller pieces. I think people thought that they might have to in order to get it passed because there were so many contentious things in there, and people thought that they wouldn't be able to pass all of it in one bill, but they would never have broken it down into enough pieces for people to notice something like that. So it's how it's always been. It's broken. Let's change it.
You know, it's this just occurs to me now, given the enormous size of these bills. And by the way, Judy, I'm in favor of putting in a $10 billion line item for kitchen sinks, just to see if anybody's paying attention. But I think with Anna, you said
before, we've already gotten faucet pressure, so sure, why not?
Yeah, put it in just as a reading test. Are we really sure that this will cost the House, the GOP, the House? And here's what I mean by that. Because of the size of these bills, because none of us can wrap our head around the entirety of it, doesn't that argue for the winners and losers here or who tells the best story about this bill? So, you know, in other words, and it's not my job to either, you know, cheerlead, apologize, or argue the president's brief, but it's not hard to concoct a story where this is a winner. Hey, there's $175 billion in here for border walls and deportations. Now, you might not like them, but that's a political winner. That's like a 70-30 issue. You know, hey, there's we're going to bring manufacturing back, and here's how we're going to do it. In other words, he who controls the narrative controls who wins and loses here. So while I tend to agree with you, Anna, that this is probably not necessarily going to redound to the GOP's favor, those of us who are in the business of storytelling, as it were, and I know you did some of that work politically, well, they've got things to work with here, right?
But I think that it's all well and good to have a good story be told, but if it's impacting your bottom line as a family, then you're not gonna vote just because you like more people deported if it means that you don't have health care, if it means that your SNAP benefits are reduced significantly, you can't feed your family. I think right. that
But we're assuming those things are gonna happen and we just don't know yet.
And I think part of the strategy is to delay the impact until after the midterm election. So
okay.
That is not going to be realized by the people who are casting ballots. I also think the Republicans view a loss in the midterms as inevitable no matter what happens with this bill. I think, you know, history is against them. And with the aggravating impacts of the tariffs, I think they know that it's kind of fruitless to even hope to keep the House.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that originally they had the work requirements for 2029 and they moved them up. And I was like, oh, I guess we think this is going to be popular and it isn't going to cost elections. Like, I thought you wanted this to show up when there was another president, but okay.
But okay. Another letter we go to. This from Nicole. I heard one of the panelists say that the SALT deduction increase was essentially asking red, low-tax states to take on more of the federal burden. It's been my understanding that the SALT deduction was to offset and help the high-tax states who subsidize the low-tax states at the federal level. Is this understanding accurate? And can the panelists speak more about it to shed more light on the issue? Thank you for your insight and all you do daily to keep me informed. I love you all, even those I don't agree with.
That means me, right?
I don't know. I don't know.
No, I don't think. If I said it was a subsidy, then I guess I misspoke. What I mean is that why should taxpayers in Florida or Texas effectively subsidize high tax states like California and New York? If you were a low tax, because what is the cap? $40,000, you said, Judy? Okay, let's be honest. Not that many of us pay $40,000 in taxes. Okay, so that is
even in New York.
Even in New York. So, if I'm a good progressive, good Democrat who favors, progressive tax policies, why do I want to give a tax break to people who are already paying that much in taxes?
Exactly. And I think what it is supposed to be a penalty for high tax states for their what is considered by the right as lavish spending.
That's right.
And I think this is these deductions or this cap is something that's particularly designed for New York City and Long Island, where the property taxes are particularly high. They're not. I mean, people in upstate New York would argue that our property taxes are high. They are not $30,000.
Go down to Westchester. Exactly. I'm a recovered Westchester resident, and I can say that the taxes are shockingly high there.
My parents paid more in property taxes on Long Island in 1975 than I pay in property taxes today here in upstate New York.
That sounds right.
Wow. All right, we go to this from George. Save Social Security by taxing at a higher limit. Save healthcare by not designing hospitals as cathedrals. Save universities by better managing research within the government and raise taxes on the assets of the exorbitantly rich. And, kill AI. We are already living in a dystopian novel.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Yes, there you go.
The Social Security one is my pet peeve. Ugh. Sorry.
No, tell me more.
Why do we cap the contributions at $150,000 of income when a lot of people make over that? And if we just made it so that people contributed for the full year, we could solve a lot of the problems of Social Security. And it just seems really weird to me that we're like, nope, $150,000, we're going to cap that. And there are some entry-level tech jobs that are paying $150,000 a year. So I think we could do better.
And my pet peeve is the one about taxing assets. I mean, didn't we all see It's a Wonderful Life, that speech that George Bailey gives about your money's not here, it's in his home. If you're going to tax assets, how are you going to raise the money to pay if you own a million-dollar home, which, by the way, in Westchester and Long Island is a
starter
modest,
home.
Exactly. and you need to pay, say, 15% taxes on that. Where are you going to get that $150,000? It's not like you're going to have it lying around.
We have...
Okay, I'm going to pile on. Because
okay, go.
I'm going to pile on because killing AI is just not... You can't just put the off button on,
exactly.
on technology. You can't do that. However... When you think about AI, Trump is taking a really different stance. I mean, under the previous administration, people were worried about the safety of AI and the ways to protect people and the ways to integrate it in society so that people are not put at undue risk. In this administration, what people are really worried about is the primacy of the U.S. in terms of AI. And that's kind of nuts. If all we care about is sort of leading in AI, we're taking really the wrong tack with something that's potentially wonderful and potentially really, really dangerous.
Do you not want to lead in AI? I do.
I absolutely want to do well in AI. So how do you do well in AI? First of all, you fund the people that are training people how to do AI. You fund universities. You make sure that AI is used safely for all the people who could have harm or risk as a result of AI making decisions in an untethered way. You put some rules around it. Putting rules around things doesn't, make them less innovative. I mean, we have to deal with gravity, right? We can't just say, yeah, I want to be in an environment where there's less gravity because, I don't like rules and I don't want to be constrained. We're going to work with those rules as we work with all of the sort of physical and legal and other kinds of rules we work with, and we can do a really good job, but we can't do a really good job if all we care about is winning.
I would be a bad American Enterprise Institute think tanker if I did not say that Sure. Putting rules around technology does not necessarily hamper innovation, but it's the way to bet.
It's the what?
It's the way to bet.
Well, I think you can't say no rules are all rules. I mean, neither of those are absolutely realistic at all. You have to put some rules around things. And those rules, the public sector is there to protect the public. The mission of the public sector is ideally public well-being. That's in the preamble for the Constitution. And it's true for governments all over the world, whether they play that out or not.
Yeah,
and if we're not thinking about the public in America around AI and the safety of AI for the people that use it, I think we're going the wrong way. That's my opinion.
I think we're talking about AI later in the show. And boy, am I looking forward to that, because boy, I have a lot to say about AI.
Oh, let you and Fran go at it. I think we can probably go get a coffee.
No, she and I might agree on that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I'll just go at the subject and we'll meet you in the
back. Robert and I would no doubt agree on this. Back to what the listener was saying, you can't kill AI.
Of course
you know,
not.
You can't stop progress in a tool that is becoming absolutely fundamental to everything we do. You can contain it. You can make it safer. You can make it better. But you can't stop it. You can't kill AI.
Yeah.
Well, if AI were running this show, it would hit our brakes on time better than I'm doing. So we'll go over and take care of that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Judy Patrick, Fran Berman, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Pundicio, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. As I mentioned, a lot of letters, so I'll read these. If anybody wants to comment, please let me know. Cheryl says, am I wrong in assuming this big, beautiful tax cut will do nothing for the average person in light of the fact that we will pay more for everything because of tariffs? Plus, the many public service cuts will inevitably cost more and actually hurt many of us, and states will likely need to raise taxes to function. The whole idea seems wrong. Then we go to Claire. John Fassler said raising contribution limits for Social Security does not help because you would have to pay those people more when they collect. That from Claire. Then we go to Sam. Religious orgs, organizations don't pay property tax. If they did, it could lower everyone's property tax, especially the Hudson Valley. Look at Ossining or Ulster County. Do you want to have a Hudson Valley perspective there?
Anna? Oh, the Westchester is far more expensive. I have paid property taxes in both of those spots, and I would pick Ulster County all day long. It's hard to beat Westchester in property taxes. I think they are literally number one in the country.
You know, if you want to have fun, you go to your local town assessor and look at their list of properties that are organizations that are exempt from property taxes. There are a lot of reasons people are exempt from taxes, including the state of New York, which owns a lot of property here in Albany, and Albany has to deal with that. But just go look, ask the assessor to look at the list of people who are people and organizations that are exempt from paying property taxes. It's fascinating. As a reporter, I love doing it.
Yeah, no, it sounds fun. Yeah.
And I just love being on WAMC and listening to panelists complaining about their taxes.
Let the record show, I love paying my taxes because I've worked in the government and I see what it pays for. And it is, you know, I want kids to have public school education. So I write that, I smile while I write my tax bill.
Smile and grit your teeth at the same time.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. Okay. That's why I had to get a tooth removed yesterday, actually. It was because of the tax bill.
Ouch. Peter says, probably no one cares, but omnibus bills such as just passed by the House are the standard process in the New York State Legislature. Well, probably all the people in this room care. Yeah.
Right. The New York State should do the same thing. Debate each issue separately. Do it. That's your job. Mm. It's not. You have a whole year. You don't need to do everything in the 2 days before Memorial Day weekend. And in fact, you know, this idea that these guys have to fly off because they need their time, their at home time with their
pressing
constituents.
Pressing the flesh.
Yeah. Well, that's campaigning. That's not my work.
I understand. we go to Jeff. Hello, panel. Robert asked how we would reduce the deficit. There are two very simple and fair solutions that would go a long way towards doing that. First of all, raise the cap on the taxable earnings on Social Security from the current cap of $176,000. Even raising it to $500,000 would be more fair than the current situation, as people earning millions of dollars currently pay a smaller percentage of their income than the poor. Also, raise the tax rates up to what they were 40 years ago when Reagan was president. The wealthy still enjoyed a very comfortable standard of living then, and they can certainly afford to pay a little more in taxes now.
If the money's being well spent, sure.
All right. We go to Nicole. I heard one of the panelists say that the – oh, no, I think I already read that. That was the that was the one that was nice to us. Maybe that was why I didn't
– Read it again. Read it again.
That's right. I didn't delete that one. It had all smiley face emojis. Bob says, I'm willing to say that raising taxes on top of on the top 1% and corporations not lowering them would go a long way towards lowering the deficit. Also, how about ending this $1 billion subsidies for oil producers? That from Bob. John says, you think there are going to be midterm elections? Really? how cute. Okay.
Better not get that bad. I mean, actually, I don't know. We're less than 200 days in, and things are pretty bleak. So
I will put my wager down right now. There will be midterm elections, folks. Take a deep breath.
Okay, so the letter goes on, and I'll just say this so John has their a complete thought read, which is the Republicans will never again allow there to be midterm elections if they think they're going to lose. And if they do, the Republicans will do everything in their power to cheat, revoking the registration of anyone who's ever voted against them in states where they have control. The question I would ask, well, how do you do that?
Right. Even in the worst case scenario in dictatorships, they have fake elections, at least. I mean, nobody ever gives up elections entirely. I think even in, you know, Putin has elections. I mean, right. I agree that there's no way we're not going to have midterm elections. There's too much of an industry about campaigns. I mean, think of the money that would be lost.
Touché.
Andy says the bill's not a disappointment to rich people. Stop trying to both sides this effort to dismantle our federal government. Are we both siding it? I don't know. All right. Then we go to Corey. Would the panel please explain? Oh, who knows tax code? Would the panel please explain the effect of the extended tax cut on different income households, households of up to $50,000, $50,000 to $100,000, $100,000 to $200,000, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I heard there's a small savings for middle income tax payers, but people who are against this bill will argue that the increases that will come in other parts of their lives that will be offset. So, you know, the idea about the standard deduction, they're increasing that a bit. I think a lot of average people have appreciated the increase in the standard deduction. So, but again, at the higher levels, those hefty tax cuts remain. So I think that there is some relief in the middle class, but everyone argues that they're going to see higher prices or higher taxes elsewhere because of it.
This kind of gets back to my point about, are we sure this will cost the Republicans? Because at the end of the day, I don't think people make decisions on a particular piece of legislation. It's just kind of an overall sense of your well-being. So, you know, how am I doing as of October 2026? Do I feel like I'm getting ahead? Am I, you know, still concerned about the price of groceries, et cetera, et cetera? It's more of a just a wellness check on the electorate.
We'll take a break and we'll be back with more. And we would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return after this break and news with Ian Pickus.
1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm Ray Graff.
And we are here to remind you that it is a good time, as good a time as any, to support WAMC as we run up to our fund drive, which begins on June 2nd at 6 a.m. We're hoping that you can help us keep the fund drive short by donating early and boosting up that lockbox total.
You almost said early and often.
No, I didn't. You can't end it often.
No.
Although it does end three times a year. That's you know.
Right, you are.
For some events, that's frequent.
We're at $315,058 in Beautiful. The lockbox so far. So it's been a great morning. It has been a great couple of mornings here as we pitch around the roundtable panel, which, by the way, is coming right back.
It is indeed.
Remember we talked about the Shatner Esperanto movie?
Yes, I do.
Kathy in Fishkill wrote in and said, Incubus with Allison Ames was the movie. Leslie Stevens wrote and directed. Esperanto was the selection for the language because it was going to be the universal language, or so folks thought back then. So there you are.
I need to read something about that, about people thought Esperanto would be the universal language. It's not something I know about, and I don't understand the statement, and so I'm going to go find out, and then I'll gain comprehension.
I mean, if it was Shatner, you'd figure it was Klingon, right? That would have been the language.
I don't think he spoke Klingon.
No.
But he knew people who did. Because in the original films and series, Klingons were all enemies, right?
Yeah, I think there might have been one or two good guys.
Okay.
But yeah,
I could
in
be
general.
Wrong.
No, you're right. And the Romulans, too.
800-323-9262, 1-800-323, or WAMC.org.
Geeking
this is
out.
This is Star Trek with Sarah and Ray.
Spock, thank some people. Okay, thanks to Anonymous in Red Hook, who is a sustainer, says, keep the airwaves public. Thanks to Sue and George in Cambridge, New York, who say hi to Joe from another Cambridge resident. Thanks to Mary in Tannersville, New York.
He waved back, just so you know.
Okay. I miss it when I don't hear it, says Mary. And thanks to Sally in Amherst, who says, I'm anxious to support my daily companion. I depend on it for objective news reporting. I've been a supporter for 50 years.
Amazing.
Sally, you win the gold star today. Thank you so much. 800-323-9262.
Your early gift powers all of the programming that we bring you on WAMC and will help shorten the fund drive if you can donate now during this locked box period. We will be briefly interrupting programming the rest of this week and next to remind you to pledge early if you can afford to, if you want the fund drive to be as quick as possible. We will interrupt programming completely beginning at 6 a.m. on June 2nd until we reach our $1.25 million goal. That is the plan. Those are the facts. The missing component is you supporting your radio station whenever
right.
you can.
And, you know, I say it again and again, but it is actually true. It's never happened, but it's actually true. If we filled the lockbox all the way in the next 10 days, no fund drive.
True.
We're well over a quarter way there. But if you want to keep it even shorter, make your pledge now. 800-323-9262. Or WAMC.org.
There will be a little bit of I would call it a soft scramble to book our programs for the week. We're planning to have a fund drive if, say, the lockbox fills up completely to $1.25 million next Friday, but we're capable of it. We know how to get people in the studio.
Yeah, I'm not even going to bother to book Vox Pop if we get no fund drive. I'll just stream of consciousness for the whole hour.
You won't.
Yes, I
won't. You would maybe faint from.
Yeah. I did that once and took calls.
Yeah,
and
just to open forum.
Yeah, and
based on nothing.
Right, and it was a crazy show. I vowed never to do it again.
Were you alone in the studio? You didn't have anybody else with
studio,
you riffing?
Yeah.
What if you pulled in another AMC-er to help? I'm not volunteering.
No. Well, I'll be alone in the studio. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Got astronomy today.
Ooh, great.
I love the astronomy show.
Those smarty pants. Dr. Yeah. Valerie Rapson is such a genius.
She is so smart. And Bob Berman, who is here to do his
listing of numbers.
Star Hustler. What's the name of the thing he does?
Strange Universe.
Strange Universe. That's it.
He should change it.
No, the Star Hustler was a thing.
Oh,
it was
okay.
On public TV.
Okay.
Greetings, okay. Greetings. 800-323-9262. But enough about the Star Guzzler. WAMC.
Did you just change it to Guzzler?
Yeah, that's what we used to say back in the old days. WAMC.org to make your secure online pledge. It's the lockbox. We're only here for a couple of minutes, folks, and then we'll be back to the roundtable panel.
Minutes, more like seconds.
800-323-9262
or WAMC.org. We'll be back a little bit later, but until then, please do enjoy the roundtable panel.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. Let me reintroduce everyone so you know who is on your radio program. Fran Berman is here, Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Also, Anna Markowitz is here, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead. Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, a former Vice President, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio. Hello, all. Thank you very much for being with us. Let's go on to new stuff and new topics as we go into our second hour here and have about a half hour left. We'll try to get to as many things as we possibly can. I would like to, we can probably take care of this one fairly quickly because we've talked about it before, but it was announced yesterday that the U.S. has formally accepted the luxury jet from Qatar for President Trump for use of Air Force One. And then it becomes his. Following that, the Secretary of Defense has accepted a Boeing 747 from Qatar in accordance with all federal rules and regulations. The Chief Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said in a statement, "The Department of Defense will work to ensure proper security measures and functional mission requirements are considered for an aircraft used to transport the President of the United States." The plane, worth $200 million.
Bad idea, folks. Bad idea. And I've talked about this on the roundtable before. The fact that it is a gift from a foreign country bothers me less than which foreign country. I'll be blunt. I don't trust the Qataris. They have thrown billions of dollars at higher ed institutions. Now this, the optics of it are just terrible. We don't need a flying palace. We need a flying White House. And this one might be a flying Trojan horse.
Judy.
Terrible idea. Terrible idea. And it's going to be bad in the long term for President Trump. But again, he doesn't really have to worry about the future because despite what a lot of people think, this is his last term. He's a lame duck. He doesn't care. He wants this shiny new thing. They, you know, the initial argument against it was going to take so long to retrofit that he wouldn't even be able to use it while he was in office. Now they're trying to speed things up so they will be able to strip it of all its, strip it down to the bare bones and build it back up. Again, a bad idea. The question now becomes, will Congress step in and take the steps it needs to do to either, you know what they're going to do? They're going to approve it anyway. So I guess going to Congress is kind of, you know, just a show. But I want the show.
Well, speaking of what Robert was saying before, you know, what should we cut in order to make the money to, you know, create a safety net or however much of that we want? Well, this is going to cost us $1 billion to retrofit. So, you know, I'll put the plane from Qatar up there on the list. Let's not do it.
And we already had two Boeing planes that were going to be ready
right.
in 2027. So we were already spending that money, and now we're just going to have a third
plane. Okay, but
plane.
This one's cooler.
Yeah, I'm sure you want all of the plushest leather chairs. But you just can't have everything, Trump. You can't.
When I become president,
what
this is my
I
vow.
Just go
I'm going to fly
and,
coach.
You know, paint everything with a bucket of gold paint in the existing room.
Yeah.
Will that help?
And I just don't think it's going to be ready as quickly as he thinks it will be. I mean, I've seen in my advance work, I've seen the insides of the limos and the buses, and those doors are thick, guys. They are thick. They weigh as much as a fire truck to have this small limo drive down the street. And so these security measures are real, and it's going to take time and $1 billion to effectively make it so that he can't get, you know, blasted by a nuclear bomb.
Why doesn't he just stay at the White House? I mean, why does he need to flit all over the world? I understand there's some, you know, diplomatic value for it, but I'm not seeing a lot of diplomatic value. I'm stay at the White House and do some work. I don't need to, you know, travel once in a while, take, you know, go travel first class. But I think this idea that he needs to use this plane, especially after he leaves the White House.
Is the senior leadership of Hamas still in Qatar?
That was my understanding of the last night. Yeah.
Enough said.
By the way, I like Judy's use of the word flit. No other reason. Just wanted to say that. All right.
I'd like to see her spend that $1 billion on air traffic controllers. That would be kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of questions and concerns within the airline industry. All right, let's go to other topics. I think we've handled that one. I thought we could dispense with it rather quickly. Okay, the persuasiveness of AI. AI is more persuasive than a human in a debate, according to a new study. Say what? That's right. When provided basic demographic information on their opponents, AI chatbots adapted their arguments and became more persuasive than humans in online debates. Technology watchdogs have long warned of the role artificial intelligence can play in disseminating misinformation and deepening ideological divides. Now, researchers have proof of how well AI can sway opinion, putting it head-to-head with humans. When provided with minimal demographic information on their opponents, AI chatbots, known as large language models, were able to adapt their arguments and be more persuasive than humans in online debates 64% of the time. That, according to a study published in the Nature Human Behavior publication on Monday. I know everyone wants in on this, but Fran, we'll begin with you.
Oh, Joe. There's so much wrong with this article and kind of misleading about the original study and what AI is capable of, that it's no surprise that the public is just often crazed by all of the stuff on AI. So let me just talk about the article. This is a study. It came out in Nature, one of Nature's publications. And what they were doing is they were looking at debates, and they paired humans with AI and humans with humans, and they looked at the results to try to compare, you know, how AI did. First of all, just know that AI is never trying to persuade. It's not trying to do anything. It's not conscious. It's doing very nuanced, large language models are doing very nuanced pattern matching. And they're fed massive amounts of data from humans. So they get an idea. Well, they don't get anything, but they can replicate some of the more persuasive human kinds of arguments through the way it's modeled, whether it's modeled with reinforcement learning or other kinds of learning. Reinforcement learning allows you to tell it what the right answer is in order to train it to learn. So what they did is they used AI to try to see if these arguments that the AI created were better than humans. The results they got, to my understanding, were it was pretty on par with humans, and when they could provide it more data about the demographics of the audience, the listeners, then the AI did better. And, you know, this is just not surprising. Back in Cambridge Analytica, when that firm was accused of swerving the 2016 election by doing psychographic targeting. So what's psychographic targeting? It uses what it thinks are the characteristics of the audience to try to create a persuasive argument. And Cambridge Analytica used data from Facebook that it had gathered actually illegally. And it was used by the Trump administration. But, of course, you know, all campaigns use some form of psychographic targeting. They have since the Kennedy election. So that was used in ways that may have swerved the 2016 election. Let me just explain briefly, and sorry for going on so long, but I think it's really important to understand the facts. So what's psychographic targeting? I'm trying to capture the characteristics of my listener. So imagine I want to give the message that we should not have gun control, that we should be quite liberal in the way we think about guns. If I'm talking to a patriot, I might want to use the argument that, you know, your fathers before you, the people who created this country, had the right to bear arms. You should have that, too. That might be the argument I would want to use. If I'm talking to somebody who's a worried parent, I might say something like, you really want to protect your children. You know, it's really important to have a gun at home in case, you know, somebody attacks you. If I'm talking to a libertarian, I might want to make the argument that, you know, government shouldn't have all these kinds of rules. They really should let you do the things you wanted. And these kind of targeted psychographic, arguments are used to try to sway voters to, like, vote against control of weapons. So what is the AI doing in places it's trying to, not trying, that's in air quotes, folks, persuade? It's actually using a greater preponderance of arguments that work with those kinds of demographics. So it's just not so much of a surprise that sort of more and more targeted data is going to help our device and our model do a better job. It's not thinking, it's not persuading. The way the humans are using it is the really important thing. There's got to be a human in the loop deciding how to use these powerful tools. So as I read this article, you know, to me it just misleads, and it just sort of fires up this notion that evil robots are going to take over the world. You know, that's just not the situation we're in.
Mm. I also read the article and had some you know, outsized reactions, Fran, but not for the same reason that you did. I felt like I was reading an op-ed by John Henry, you know, warning about the ominous unchecked power of the steam engine. There was a line in the piece, and I'm not sure who this cybersecurity and AI expert is, who says, they are often, meaning AI, they're often tuned to say what people want to hear rather than what's necessarily true. And I imagine the Washington Post op-ed columnists thinking, hey, wait, that's my job. I'm supposed to be the person telling people what they want to hear instead of what's necessarily true. I mean, at the risk of diverting us, I couldn't help but be thinking, like, wait, but this is the paper that's warning us about AI and its ability to persuade is the paper that ignored Joe Biden's infirmities for years. So there's a little bit of gallows humor in this, I suppose, about how the people, and look, I'm in this business too, right? Those of us who put words on paper trying to persuade people. Yeah, there's a very real possibility that AI is simply better at this than we are.
True. AI generates mush. So, I've seen obituaries, AI obituaries. It's full of what we're seeing in the popular culture generated by AI is not imaginative. It is not personal. It's not. It falls short of what we need. I understand that it has some use going forward in terms of eliminating societies, some of these routine mechanisms that we do, almost much like calculator. Did. But I'm in your class last week at Bennington, you know, one of the young students said, you know, is AI worth the value that is costing our society in terms of generating, you know, the power needed to make these computers run? Is this something we really should, isn't this something our society should be talking about? So, I mean, we see the incidents in which, you know, King Syndicates distributed a book reading list, a summer recommendation of book reading list of 20 books, half of which were not even books. Mm-hmm. And it got into print in a number of newspapers. People will argue, well, that's the fault of the editors or the companies for not checking it. But I think what our society is doing is undermining the value of original thought. And AI is only as good as the internet it scrapes, and it's not scraping everything. It's not, for example, scraping a lot of local newspapers.
Yeah.
And so you're not getting
That was a great question, and I think we do have to think about. I mean, DeepSeek, which is the Chinese AI, notwithstanding, which is more power efficient, which is not to say efficient than other large language models, but I think we have to think about the power and all the other ways. But let me just really, really try to reinforce the fact that AI is a tool. AI is not intentional.
Yep.
It's a very powerful tool. It's a really useful tool. If I want to, saw through a giant log, I want to use a chainsaw. But it's just a tool. It is not thinking. It is not feeling. It does not have compassion. It does not have ethics. If it does something that is ethical, it's because we fed it a lot of stuff when we said copy that in its learning. None of this is sort of original the way it is with human beings. And the thing I really worry about in terms of how we are dealing with AI is not that it won't be super useful in doing a lot of stuff. If you think about this, as human beings, we do a lot of pattern matching.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the kinds of jobs that AI is starting to do within our society are things that where people do a lot of pattern matching. They do a lot of sort of rote stuff. But AI is not going to replace, your spider sense. AI is not going to replace your wisdom. AI is not going to replace your compassion or your sensitivity.
Yeah.
It's mathematics, and it's not going to be able to do that. And so when we think about what is the best use for this tool, and there are many really great uses for it, we shouldn't be thinking this is another being in cyberspace. It's not another being.
Yep.
And so this notion that AI is not intentional, I think I'm just missing from so many of the stories where we read about AI and we anthropomorphize what AI is. I think that's really important. As Joe knows and the rest of you don't know, I've been writing this book on tech, which hopefully will be out next year. I'm signing the contract with MIT Press now. And there's like a whole chapter about what should we be able to expect.
I just have to wrap you up. We have to take a quick break, but my spidey senses tell me it's time for a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I love and respect books far too much than to interrupt Fran as she was plugging her forthcoming book. So, Fran, please tell us what the book is and when it will be out and after the fine folks at MIT Press accept the contract.
After the fine folks of MIT Press and a million reviewers and copy editors and I talked them down from putting evil robots on the cover. It really is about a lot of the themes that I talk about here. It's about technology and society, how technology impacts society, and what control, which is a great deal, that humans have over how technology impacts in society. And it gives a lot of strategies for how we can promote the public interest. So I won't take any more of your time today, but I'll bug you, Joe, and maybe I can come and talk about the book when it's out next year.
We would love that and expect it, quite frankly. So let us talk about – I did include because they – and Judy mentioned it, but they really do overlap these stories when it comes to what happened with the book list. Again, my concern over over books, but it was really interesting to me, and the fact that and for those of you who are not familiar with this, so this reading list went on the Chicago the Chicago sometimes, and they were doing book recommendations. And I think anyone who reads the book section of a publication of a newspaper sees these all the time. The New York Times does them all the time. 20 books for summer, 20 books for to make you laugh, or whatever the case may be. And sometimes they're good, and sometimes, you know, they seem a bit forced, but whatever the case may be. So now they tuck this this into a special section. There were books there by Delia Owens and Britt Bennett, a novel by Percival Everett, who just won the Pulitzer Prize. The one issue is none of the book titles attributed to those authors were actually real. So if you were a book nerd and you thought, oh, Percival Everett has a new book, he doesn't? Okay, all right. Then it was learned that these had been created by generative artificial intelligence. The latest case of bad AI making its way into the news, while AI has improved, there is still no way to ensure the systems produce accurate information. The Chicago Sun-Times printed this. They apologized. The Philadelphia Inquirer also printed this. They apologized, condemning the use of AI, and in part blamed King Features, a Hearst syndicate that licenses content nationally. The syndicate produced a 56-page supplement called Heat Index, Your Guide to the Best of Summer, which also included things like summer food trends and activity recommendations. Wouldn't it be cool if they found out that some of the things that they recommended weren't really food?
Wait, this isn't bad AI. This is bad fact-checking. This is bad journalism. Like, why are we blaming AI for this? Whose head is going to roll over this? Come on.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're just getting used to using AI.
Right.
I'm a new user of AI and have had, I don't know, like a 50% rate of misinformation come out of it, and which I find kind of startling. Every time I'm like, wait, that's not right. And it's just because I've grown up my whole life not having AI that I am questioning it and am saying, hey, well, let me look into if this is accurate or not. And I think as we get as we start using this for more and more years, we might get lazy and say, oh, well, it said, you know, blah de blah, so it must be right. And I think that that's what we're going to really have to learn as humans, that our role is to be thinking, you know, really practically about what information we're getting and be able to identify fake information from real information and be able to problem solve.
Yeah, this is the same thing 25 years ago when Google came out. There was a lot of stuff. I work in education, and there was a lot of, you know, talk about, well, you know, we really don't need to teach kids facts anymore. Knowledge, why do we need knowledge in the age of Google? You can just look it up. And for complicated reasons I will not bore you with, it's just not so. You know, you have to be able to exercise some discernment to evaluate what you're getting from Google. AI is, I don't want to say that AI is a fancy search engine, but the same principle applies. And Anna, you're exactly right. I'm fairly new to this myself. I found it enormously useful. I've been joking lately that AI is making me more productive and route to making me obsolete. But I had an experience within the last couple of months. I was asked to write an op-ed for the New York Post on their literacy programs. And I used it the way I would, if I had more time, ask a research assistant at AI to do, hey, give me a lit review on these studies on reading comprehension. In 90 seconds, it gave me a bewilderingly complicated or good research file. But there was a study in it that I remember thinking, wait a minute, how do I not know this? I'm supposed to be an expert in literacy and reading comprehension. There's this 2017 study. I've never heard of this. Well, it turns out it was literally made up. It didn't exist. So once you have that experience once, you realize, hey, wait a minute. You know, and this is why I have not a lot of sympathy, Joe, for the Chicago Sun-Times. If they are just putting, you know, give me a list of 20 books and without checking, printing it, shame on them.
Yeah, shame on them. Also, here's what pisses me off. I apologize. But here's what ticks me off on this subject is that I would gladly provide a summer reading list for 2025 for readers of the Chicago Sometimes for free. I would love to give people book recommendations. I have them coming out of my pores.
Can I tell you a true story about this? So back in the day, I worked at Time Magazine, and I was, as I like to say, their paid principal apologist. When there was a train wreck, you know, I was the guy whose phone rang. And so there was a book reviewer, the late Stephen Canfer, who
Stephen
printed
Canfer.
Terrific guy. This may not have been his best day.
Yes.
We ran a list of the 10 best children's books that he authored that was literally exactly the same as a previous list from a few weeks before of the 10 best children's books from the New York Times. And I remember getting a call from Howie Kurtz, then the media critic of the Washington Post. And this was my best moment in spin doctoring. I think this quote appeared in the Post. I said, Stephen Canfer has been reviewing books for 30 years. He is perfectly capable of making up his own mind. Now, if you parse that statement carefully, I didn't say that he did. I just said that he was perfectly capable of doing so.
Perfectly capable of doing so. Fran.
Yeah, I agree with these guys. It's not the fault. As if it was human, which it is not, of AI. The media is worrying about budget like the rest of us, and they're going with freelancers, and the freelancers are using AI, and it's the media's job to be fact-checking and to be making sure that everything it gets from freelancers or people on staff is accurate. And this is clearly not accurate. You know, if you think about what the AI is doing, the AI is, looking at a lot of data, and then it's filling in the gaps. So it might, the data might tell it that certain authors are really popular, but it doesn't have a title from those authors. It'll make something up. And it's not surprising, but our job as humans, I mean, I just think the comment that we have to basically don't trust and verify. We are using these tools. Just because somebody gives me a box of tools doesn't mean I am now a craftsman who can, let the tools do everything without my supervision. Humans have got to be supervising their own use of AI, especially in high-risk environments. So, okay, so if AI recommends a book that doesn't exist, or in my son's case, my son's a mathematician, and once he asked AI something and it recommended a theorem that didn't exist, so be it. No one's going to die. But in high-risk situations where we are asking AI to come up with an answer that will be important in decision-making, people's prison sentences, when we talk about performance evaluations, when we think about, candidates, for the crime lineup, those kinds of things, those are higher risk environments, and you must have humans in the loop in order to reduce the risk. In this case, it's amusing and dumb and, a problem of not enough people with their eyes on the wheel. But it's really important to have humans in the loop when AI is helping as a tool to make decisions that make a difference.
We're going to have to end it there. My thanks to everyone who participated this morning, our wonderful panel. Fran Berman, it's always a wonderful just treat to hear your voice, and I thank you so much for being with us.
Have a great day, everybody.
You too. Be well. Anna Markowitz, thank you so much. Judy Patrick, Robert Pendicio, you're all wonderful, and enjoy the weekend.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks so much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.